What we need is probably modern technology to translate from Australian to American. I have never been so beautifully welcomed. Thank you. And what struck me as you're saying that is whatever theological differences may be in this room, and whatever differences of theology someone may have with even the name Michael Morwood, which provokes reaction in some places, is that we seem to get about that. And that's what I appreciate. So thank you, thank you. I was ordained in 1969. 15 years after I was ordained, I went to Boston College and did a master's degree in pastoral theology and ministry. In one of the summer courses I did a course on ministry for aging. And the lecturer was Kathleen Fisher. With her book, Winds of Grace. 1984. And one of the things that strikes me is that, and this will be common to many of us, I'm sure, in 1984, I could not have imagined that I would be where I am today, theologically. And I could not have imagined in 1984 that my church would be so divided. I could not. There were indications. When I wrote my first book in 1991, which had an imprimatur and a nickel offstart, and then I found myself under attack, this was like, whoa, what's going on? I did not know the divisions that were underlying in our church. And I think one of the things that we have to come to terms with wherever we are theologically is the fact that we are living through the greatest shift ever in Christian history. And not only the greatest shift ever in Christian history, we are living through the greatest shift in worldview in human history, I think. In 1984, I had no idea of the immensity of the universe. I mean, it was not like 1969, we had the first picture of our planet from space. I had no idea. Quantum physics, quantum mechanics was totally foreign to me. I had no idea about genetics. My faith journey in those last 23 years, if I could try and put it in simple terms, was that as a Catholic, and I still think I was, and I still think I am, a loyal Catholic, to the surprise of many people. But I think the shift that I got caught in, and that many of us got caught in, was around the most fundamental aspect of our faith, and that is the notion of God. I keep saying to groups, when I was a little Catholic boy, the first thing I ever learned about God was that God is everywhere. We all learned that, didn't we? In the seminary, and as I read theology, I came to appreciate, to understand from my Catholic Christian tradition that God is that reality that pervades everything, sustains and holds, and nothing can exist outside of God. And in my journey in the last 20 years, if I've tried to be faithful to anything in my Catholic background, it is to be faithful to that fundamental concept and understanding of the mystery we call God. God is everywhere. That's the language of our tradition. It's the language of the mystics. It's the language of intimacy. It's the language of relationship. It's the language of connectedness. I also think it's the language of Jesus of Nazareth. It's the language of Pentecost. But we also have another tradition, and it's like, this is part of the shift that we caught in. It's part of what causes divisions amongst us and arguments when, you know, people ask questions coming out of one sort of worldview. And people in another sort of worldview find it difficult to get back at. The other tradition is what I would call the theological tradition. And I learned that when I was about 6 years of age. And I got grounded in a theological worldview. And the theological worldview in which I was grounded as a Catholic was a theological worldview of separation, of distinction, of alienation, and about what I call now the elsewhere God. So I learned very early, as a young Catholic boy, the story of Adam and Eve. It was taken literally, of a fall, of a God who, as it were, locked the gate. It was a story of separation. It was a story now of, well, how do we get back to where God is? And this is relevant today when we look at the book, because where are our questions coming from? How do we answer questions about what happens when we die? Where do people go? I mean, even the language, you know? Where do people go? Where do we go when we die? It's the elsewhere language. It's like God lives in heaven. And I grew up with this God because this is the God of Scripture. This is the God of our creed. This is the God of our tradition. This is the God of my prayer life for most of my life. And this God, I give lip service to it. I say, yes, God is everywhere. Yes, God is everywhere. But I have been nurtured so strongly in my Roman Catholic tradition for imagining that God really lives in a place called heaven. And I grew up imagining that when I died, I was going to go where God lives. We call that place heaven, like, or something else. And my invitation to you today is to try and have a sense of appreciation of the shift that is going on here. Because if I move from that sense, I'm not talking about an elsewhere deity who's out there overseeing, looking down, intervening. I'm trying to do what my Catholic tradition has told me to do and take seriously. So let me quote from our tradition. Gregory of Nyssa: God is incapable by being grasped by any term or any idea or any device of our apprehension. We've got to stop imagining God like a superhuman person. And we say, oh, but, you know, God is God, you know? I mean, let me invite you to examine the lifelong image of a deity in heaven who thinks about things, who plans, who reacts, who intervenes. Hey, this is a projection of us. This is a projection of us. We're making God, and we think by saying God is person, that we're saying the greatest thing imaginable about God. Now, it helps us to think of God as a person. I'm not saying don't do that. But the moment we literalize that image and say that's what God is, we get hooked into the elsewhere God. And then we start asking our questions about what happens when we die. We go to where God is. And even in the book, Kathleen raises the question, how can a loving God send people to a place of everlasting punishment? See, what's the image of God that's operating? A divine being somewhere, you know, who thinks. Look at our images growing up. I imagine as a teenager, you know, if I die tonight, this is a teenager, Michael Moore, if I die tonight, I'd be going to go to hell.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's so common of Catholic males my age. Oh, if that wasn't, you know, if I got to confession, you know, that I was going to go where God lived, there'd be some sort of meeting, God would greet me, speak English, and say, Michael, what's the point? And that's the third chapter we're looking at this morning. And that's the challenge facing us today. Are we going to try and deal with the questions that are so essential to us, like the mystery of death? Will we try and we're not going to find answers, but will we keep exploring in terms of an old paradigm? As if God is out there and heaven is up there, and we've got this deity up there who does this or doesn't do that and so on. What's our understanding? What can we use today to point to this mystery that Gregory Nyssa says, hey, it's beyond anything you can imagine? Oh, by all means, let's have our images. God is a loving mother, God is a loving father. By all means, could we need that? But let us not literalize the image. That's our constant mistake. We even deal with Jesus. Jesus comes from God. Where is God in that? And scriptures do it. God so loved the world that God sent his only son. Where is God in that statement? God is elsewhere, huh? So God is heaven. The Hebrew people said, faithfully, God is everywhere. If I go to the east, you are there, my God. If I go to the middle world, you are there, my God. But their God also intervened, huh? Their God chose one group and not another group. This is a human construct. We've got to recognize that. And we've also got to recognize that we, most of us in this room, we are steeped in the imagination. And what we tend to do is say, hey, this is our faith. As if I move away from this, I am being disloyal. And people ask questions, what's in this world? And they say, well, look, I'm not really there anymore. You're not a Catholic, huh? You're not a Christian. Because we keep trying to shape questions and answers in that worldview. And your children and your grandchildren are not in that worldview anymore. And the task of the church, this is what I get out of there for. The task of the church today is to bring the freeing message of Jesus of Nazareth to this age. In the images, the worldview, the understanding. It's not that we're going to canonize our worldview today, because in 100 years, 200 years, it will keep changing.
Yep.
And then the task of the church will be bring the message of Jesus to this understanding. But don't make the mistake of locking it into a worldview of 2,000 years ago, which was a flat earth, and heaven was up there, and saying, this is it, it can never change. And then we ask our questions about, where do we go when we die? What's it all about? That's my introduction. In chapter 11, Kathleen talks about intimacy and immensity and order. And I want to look at that. Chapter 12, she talks about beauty and love. Chapter 13 is about second chances, which I want to suggest, I think, comes pretty much out of that other worldview, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Not sort of, you know, reincarnation and purgatory. Yeah, if you're in that worldview in which we're grounded as Catholics or as Christians, yes, those questions make sense. But let's look at another. Let's look at something of the contemporary world in which we live. And please understand me, I am not pretending this and saying this is the answer, huh? I am not doing that. You cannot canonize this and say, now you solve the mystery. Okay? All I want to do today is present a worldview and say, now, this is where I stand today. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I really do. What's it saying to you? And even if you disagree with it, which is fine, at least can you hear someone presenting a worldview that may well belong to your friends, your neighbours, your sons, or your grandchildren, your daughters, or whoever, huh? So that even if we disagree, we have a sense of appreciation, hey, there's something shifting here. You don't have to agree. Okay. Some of you have seen me do this before. I think, yeah. This is a bit unfair, but it's like many of us sort of struggle with the image of God. You know, we say God is everywhere, but it's still like in our prayer. We're praying as if there is a deity between male, or even though we say God is not male anymore. But do you look at the prayers we pray now, liturgy?
Mm-hmm.
Look at the hymns we sing. Who are they addressed to us? It's like there's a listening person out there. And God hears my prayer. Isn't the hymn we sing today? God hears the cry of the poor. Where does God hear the cry of the poor?
In us.
Yeah. And if we don't respond, well, you can sing all day long if you like, but but it's not saying, now God, you do something, you know? I think that's part of the sort of tussle that many of us are in. Yes, yes. And it's like a bit hard to give up on what we call the personal God. And the only way we can imagine the personal God, God is like, it's localized somewhere. And we hang on to that because God knows Michael Norwood. God likes me. I can have a father-son or a mother-son relationship with this. Huh? And that's fine. That's fine. But the moment I localize it into a super being out there, I've made a great mistake. And then we start asking the wrong questions. Why did God do this? Or why did God do that? You know? Why did God give me cancer? Why did God take my husband? Why did God let my baby die? Why did God let my house being burned down and people next to me, their house wasn't? Okay, this image of God is still rampant about it. Like the overseer, the full button. Are we still trying to ask our questions or even relate with this understanding of God? St. Augustine says, God transcends our minds. St. Thomas of Aquinas, by its immensity, the divine substance surpasses every form our intellect reaches. And Thomas Aquinas was very strong in that. He said, all our language can do with God is point to a mystery, and then you've got to say, and that's not what it is. God is beyond that. All our language, all our images about God can only point. They can be helpers, but you can never get to a point and say, now that's exactly what God is. Now we've got this all worked out. No. God is beyond that. The most influential of all the mystics, Pseudo-Dionysius, says God is not soul or mind. Now get your thought around that. God is not soul or mind, does not possess imagination, condition, speech or understanding. And this is our tradition. And I would imagine most, if I read that on a Sunday, most Catholics would think I was reading heresy. Mm-hmm. Right? What do you mean God does not possess speech or understanding or even have the imagination? Because all we're doing is putting human constructs on God. And we have God who acts like we do. God cannot be spoken of and cannot be grasped by our understanding. Whoa. So how can I reverence that? How can I honour that truth and yet still make sense of Jesus of Nazareth and who we are as Christians and our binding with all of creation and the mystery we call God and what it is to be church and the questions we ask about death and dying? Well, I'll give you half an hour to deal with that.
Could you read that Dionysius statement again?
Let me just, I'll leave it on the table down there, okay? Or I'll leave it here, so you can just grab it. I probably did, the first part of what I'm going to do now, I probably did last time I was here, but a good teacher always repeats study. Okay. So an image that I learned, and again it was after I studied at Boston, when I went to Parkes and saw the radio telescope in Australia, which was plotted the journey to the moon. And when you go into the visitor centre of Parkes, it's sort of like an information statistics about our universe. And it says if we were to imagine planet Earth the size of a grain of sand, and put that grain of sand in an area the size of Australia. Well, worst thing was to the United States of America. Okay, imagine this. A grain of sand in an area the size of the United States of America. That's our place in the Milky Way galaxy. This one grain of sand. We have not yet travelled to the next grain of sand. And humankind, as we know it, we won't do that. We won't. We may get to Mars, but we're not going to get to the next sun. We will never move outside the realm of this star that we call our sun. And this galaxy in which we live has hundreds of millions of stars like our sun. We won't ever move outside the realm of this star. Today, 100 years ago, less than 100 years ago, that we learned that there were other galaxies. And once you learn that, then immediately what happens to our image of God, or understanding of God, expands. Because all our Christian theology was done on the understanding that planet Earth was the centre of the universe, and it was flat, and you hold it up down language. And what happened on planet Earth was the greatest thing that ever happened anywhere in the universe. We were the same. And this life form emerged. We were the jewel in God's crown. And it's like God hovered over this little planet, like this. And this is all God was concerned about. What was happening here and choosing this person. Our theology comes out of that. A grain of sand in an area the size of the United States of America is our place in this galaxy. And what have we learned in the last 30 years or so? What have we seen with the Hubble telescope? You put a 5-cent piece up in the sky and look in the area covered by that 5-cent piece at an arm's length, and the Hubble telescope says you will see 1,500 at least galaxies. And you do that all around the sky, And it tells us that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies out there. Hundreds of billions of galaxies. If you want to expand our notion of the grain of sand, a grain of sand, the area of the United States, our place in the Milky Way galaxy. Well, what do we say? What's our place in the universe with this grain of sand? Well, you have to say, the Earth? A bit bigger than that, you think? What about 10 minutes? A grain of sand in the space of 10 planet Earths. Our place in the universe? What about 100 Earths? What about 1,000? No. What about 1,000,000? No. What about 1,000,000,000 Earths? No. What about maybe about 4 billion planet Earths and a grain of sand? And that is our place in the universe. Now, I don't know what it does to you, but what it does to me, First of all, how arrogant. How arrogant for a life form on this grain of sand in this immensity to say, we've got God figured out. God is just, a bit like us, God's a bloke sort of a thing up in the sky. Wow. The second thing it does, what just happened to our understanding of this mystery we call God, if God is everywhere? In other words, we have to stop the theological mindset. Well, this is the challenge, I think. Whether you want to stop it is personal choice, huh? But for me, it's a challenge to stop doing it. It's to move away from that theological mindset in which I have been nurtured, which I've been ingrained. Hey, you think that this is the way it is? And if I'm dealing with the localized elsewhere being, I say, no, God is everywhere. And then I go back into Gregory of Nyssa and Thomas Aquinas and Augustine and the mystics. I am standing in my Catholic tradition. and I'm saying the mystery of God blows my mind. And I'm left with mystery, mystery, mystery. Where is God? And some of you would have seen me do this before. This is not the Milky Way, though. This is a picture of a galaxy whiteout. We will never ever take a photo of the Milky Way from outside. Never. We're not going to do the way for this one star. But just to help our imagination, so where is God? So let this pink sheet represent what Kapling speaks about in chapter 11, about the grandeur of God. That lovely poem of Jeremy Manning Hopkins where he talks about that the earth is charged with the grandeur of God. Let us try to enter into an appreciation of a universe, not just this one galaxy, but hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars, all charged with the grandeur of mystery we call God. God is that mystery beyond our human imagination that holds everything in existence, and nothing exists outside of God. And if I were to take this away, then that disappears. Outside of God, there is nothing. So will you and I move away from a theological imagination that sort of says, oh, God is really up here somewhere. Right? The up-down stuff. Will we try and see the way that we are still influenced by that theological mindset? Heaven is up there. God is up there. You know, like when we die, we're going to go up where God really lives, to a place called heaven. Or that my mother and father are up there somewhere. And they're not. They're not up there somewhere. Heaven is not up there. There is no up, as we'll see in a minute. 4.5 billion years ago in our galaxy, a supernova exploded. We didn't have images like this until the Hubble telescope took a photo of the supernova exploding. Billions of times the energy of our sun, our star. And the scientific story tells us that every atom in our body was manufactured in that explosion 4.5 billion years ago. Every atom in our body. Every atom in our body has been on, in different forms, has been on a cosmic journey for 4.5 billion years. And the scientific story, you can pick up Paul Davies, one of the most eminent physicists in the world today, and Paul Davies in black and white says that there are atoms in our bodies that were once in dinosaurs, in the Buddha, and in Jesus of Nazareth. Imagine that! And when you burn this body, or bury it, or whatever, matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Every atom in my body is going to keep. It'll be transformed. What happens to my consciousness? We'll come back after the break, folks. We'll do that. But what we're telling here, what we are starting to tell now, is not a story of disconnectedness with God. This is not a story of disconnectedness, as if God is somewhere else looking on. This is a story of a divine presence, the mystery beyond our imagination, in which everything exists. In whom, if you like, doesn't matter what language you use, it's beyond our human language. In this mystery, this divine presence, everything unfolds and exists. The mystery we call God is that mystery that holds everything in relationship, connectedness, sustain, holding existence, and energizing. And I'm talking now about presence that is co-extensive with the universe, and the scientists tell us that there may well be other universes. I'm not dealing with a lifeline superseding in the sun. The mystery of God is beyond imagination. That's awesome. That is awesome, because you then come to this extraordinary place. I guess the straight up line, that's not fair.
There is no up.
There is no up. As I said here, you know, in Australia, we can either go up and we go to heaven, or where are you going to go? Because you're heading somewhere else.
But the extraordinary thing, this is Gerard Manley Hopkins, and this again is our tradition, that from the moment of its existence, this planet is charged with what we would call the creative presence or spirit of God. You know, I learned a story that gave witnesses, and that, oh no, you know, sort of God created, and it was flat, and then we made a mistake, or Adam and Eve, and God withdrew. And then, you know, Revelation was about God choosing a special group. And that Jesus came from God, came down. He lived amongst us, he went up again, sent the Spirit down. That's our theological imagination. That's the imagination in which our Catholic creed was shaped. And we give it reverence because that's their worldview. We give it reverence today, but today I want to reverence the fact, hey, from the moment of its existence, this planet has been charged with God's presence. You can't take the tin sheet away. You can't do this. You cannot say we are born into a state of utter separation from God. Oh, I'd get hard, wouldn't I? What are the implications for original sin when you start doing that? Hey? Most of us as youngsters were taught with all the authority of the church that we were born into a state of separation from God, and only if you got that time would you be able to go to heaven where God is. This is our imagination, and I want to say it is not the imagination of Jesus of Nazareth. This happened 300 years after he died that we got into this. Did Jesus come from God? Of course he did. Of course he didn't. Where's God? Did Jesus go to the crowds and say, God's not with you? No, he didn't. Open your eyes and see, when you live in love, you live in God. He's trying to give people a message of connectedness. A message for all human people. A message that the human species, if it could grasp, would have helped them enormously. But within two generations, I don't want to do this today, but within two generations of Jesus dying, the story was changed. And Jesus got locked into this imagination of a fall, a lockout, and someone who came down from another place, and off we went. And the mystics were saying, hey, hang on, whoa. Hey, what about this? And I think the mystics got drowned by theological emotions. And that's what we're fighting with today. An argument amongst us. Let me just say this and then we'll have a bit of stretch. So this presence that we call the creative presence of God has been here all the time. And then a life form develops on this planet. I can't do it. So now the theological and the spiritual question is, not just who are we, but what are we? We are a life form that gives this divine presence a way of coming to expression. We are a life form that gives this awesome mystery that we put this word God on. You and I give that mystery, that presence, a way of coming to expression. So does everything in the universe. It's not God. I'm not God. God is beyond us. Why wasn't I nurtured into this understanding as a little Catholic boy? Why wasn't I told to look at the treasure that this earthen vessel holds? Why was I constantly told that the earthen vessel is not much good, get your act together and then you might get close to God one day? Why did I get locked into an understanding of Eucharist as if Eucharist primarily is about someone bringing the presence from somewhere else to me?
instead of doing what Jesus did, because you are a Christian. Now, ritual offers and freedom.
It's all a different model.
Why do we get locked into a story that says,
oh, no, it can't be like that. Everyone's born into a state of separation from God, and only if you become Catholic are baptized.
See?
So, who is Jesus here?
Is Jesus primarily someone who gets us to another place where God lives? Is that what getting to heaven is about? I mean, look at how funeral imagery. Okay? There's a full of imagery and language. Angels take him or her to God the Most High, huh? Has God been merciful, give her good judgment? Where is God?
I'll just go for another few minutes and we'll have a break.
Can I ask a question?
Let me just do this and then we'll have all the questions. Otherwise I won't finish off before break. While Maria and Kathy and I have been driving around, we have several weeks on the east coast and now the west coast, just before I left home, a doctor friend of mine gave me a set of tapes, or a set of CDs, by a geneticist named Bruce Lipton, who's written a book, The Biology of Belief. And this set of CDs is just outstanding. He's one of the foremost geneticists. And what blew our minds as we listened, he says, our bodies are a community of 50 trillion cells.
50 trillion cells? Come on.
And each cell has something like, 100,000 receptors.
That's what's going on there.
And he talks about the breakthrough this man made. He said, we've been accustomed to think that it's the DNA in the cell that's like controls everything and controls our genetic background and all this. And his breakthrough was to discover that, no, it's not. It's not the DNA at work itself. He said, it's the membrane around each cell, which is so thin you can't see without a super microscope. It says that this membrane reads the environment and it tells the DNA what to do. And this is going on in our bodies in 50 trillion cells. And what blows my mind is, it doesn't think about it. It doesn't think about it. It doesn't. Is this intelligence? Is it mind operating? What's going on in there? Then the other image that blew our mind, I remember seeing several years ago in a film someone talking about the carbon atom. He said, if you expanded one carbon atom to the size of this hall, then the mass of the atom would be about the size of a full stop somewhere. So in other words, it's all empty space. That's how much sort of mass is in an atom. This geneticist says, he says, if you could reduce yourself and get inside that little bit of mass, and you could look around inside, and you could take a camera, and you look around this little bit of mass, and you're taking snapshots of what's there, then you come back to full life and you develop a film. And he says, what would you see? He said, you'd see nothing. Nothing. It is because that mass is not solid. It's composed of energy. It's like little typhoons of energy spinning around. And the spinning of this energy is perceived by us as solid. Now we've probably heard that before. But think about the implications of that. We live in a material world, huh? We think everything is solid. Our perception. This is solid. And here is contemporary science and contemporary quantum physics saying to us, we're living in an illusion. It's not that it's not real, it's not illusionary like that. Now, use the pink shirt and say, what's this all about? What's this all about? Where is God? He has another image, and I'll finish with this before we have a break.
I mean, what I'm trying to say there with this image is to say, you put this big sheet right into every cell in our body. And it's not about, you know, a conscious intelligence making decisions. It's about energy at work. You know, we are composed of, you know, layers and bursts of energy. So my sense today is that if we want language to talk about God or the mystery of God, then the best language we have is the energy of work in our universe. I am not saying God is the energy, no. But what I'm saying is use that to as a pointer to the mystery of God. God is that reality that holds, sustains, holds everything in relationship and energizes in existence. But when it comes to this life form, what is the best possible way for this life form to give expression to that reality? To live in life. Because when we want to live in love, we live in right relationships, connectedness, and we are energized. We give the best possible expression to the mystery that we call God. Bruce Lipton has this image, and he says it's an analogy, a breakdown. So I'll finish with this and we'll have a break and we can have our questions from this. It says, try and deal with the mystery of God. It's a bit like, he says, you remember when television first started? And we used to have test patterns.
Right.
Maybe that's because television in Australia didn't come to 1956 with the energy game. You had it well back then, didn't you? But, you know, we used to have a test pattern on for hours before television came. The program, you know, get tested. And he goes, think of ourselves like television sets. And each one of us is giving expression to the broadcast. What's the broadcast? The broadcast is the mystery we call God. And we fine-tune ourselves to give the best possible reception to this mystery we call God. That's our task. That's my task as a human person. How can I fine-tune myself so that I give the best possible expression to this awesome mystery? And Jesus of Nazareth did it right on the sitting now right on the head. You expand your notion of neighbour, you live in good relationships, and you didn't teach stuff. And you talked about a way of life, huh? It's about love, about living in correct relationships. So let's do that. Let's live that. Let us fine-tune our relationships and how it, and then this mystery will be seen in us. Okay. But this mystery dies. The television set breaks down. It's kaput. What happens to the mystery? The broadcast still goes on. Now, as I listen to that, as I think about it, and I have to say, look, I'm struggling with this, like, and he would say, look, it's an analogy, you know. But my sense is that what we have done, when we have so sort of canonized ourselves as separate entities, like a television set's the important thing, huh? Right? I demand that this television set lives forever. I am it. No, I'm not it. I'm not it. For something greater than I. And when the television set has had its day, that will keep going. Then the mystery becomes, well, what is my conscious relationship with that mystery? That's what we're going to look at in a bit, huh? And that will be a little question after, but I think one of the traps that we get caught into is that our theology has told us we are the greatest thing in the world. And there's something in us that demands that I live on. And that I'm conscious. Now the television set has got to live on. The television set can be done. But having been part of this mystery, we believe, and we believe it's been gathering around the story of Jesus, that death is not the end. But my sense is, let me not canonize Michael Moore. Death is going to transform this television set, if you like, into a way of living on in the mystery. But it's going to be totally and utterly beyond my human imagination, my human images, my human language. Otherwise we're simply wanting to reproduce our human situation, huh? Does my mother live on in the mystery I call God? Yes, she does. Is my mother present to me? Yes. She lives in God, she died in God, she's part of the mystery that I call of God, of the divine presence. She's present to me, and I can't describe how that presence is, but it's real to me. What I'm not doing anymore though is thinking of my mother as elsewhere. I'm not thinking of purgatory, I'm not thinking of reincarnation because she didn't measure up in this life. And I can go to the image of Jesus with that? No. I think the mystery we are facing in death is the mystery of transformation in this reality. And it's a transformation for what is living on in this mystery that is utterly and totally beyond our human imagination. But the only way we can deal with it is with human images, huh? So our human images help us from it. But let our images trap us into a sense that God is up there with a judgment about whether we're getting in or not. I don't know where you are, but I've left that behind, huh? No. What's the connectedness between living in love now and living on in God? We know. There's some connection, I think. I think Jesus was pretty good on it. If you visit it, if you care, if you love, if you try your best, come in. If you want. If you never visit it, that's a strong word, huh? If you never visit it, you never care, you never close. Well, there's a mystery here. And how many people do we know who have never kept this promise? The other image of Jesus that I would hold to in dealing with this, and again, Jesus is not individual, you know. I mean, part of the brilliance of, well, Jesus is in saying, hey, it's all here, that's his brilliance. But Jesus didn't know quantum mechanics, he didn't know the science of the universe. But Jesus was able to give people extraordinary images. And the one that I would really hold on to is the image of the prodigal son coming home. Jesus saying, you're going to give me a graciousness that's beyond you. It's never done. Dealing with mystery. My understanding is that when I die, I am going to die into a graciousness beyond my imagination. That is beyond my human image. And I'm inclined now not to use or lock my imagination or my thoughts into those images like I'm going to go somewhere else or like I get in purgatory, hell, or whatever. No. Let me focus on being the best fine-tuning I can. Let me focus on trying to spread this message that's universal, inclusive, and there's a deal about death in me. So folks, let's go break and then we're going to talk about it.